now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades. This is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
It seems like the price of housing in Southern California is not available at any price.
I just heard a figure. It's going to go up on the average $183 for everybody over the next year.
City Hall is on its way to requiring developers to help pay for affordable apartments. The governor, by the way, also signed legislation that could lead to a $4 billion in new housing funds. But the problem is that just keeps adding to the cost of the property. And one of the other reasons, and this is something that for all the belly aching about L.A. and California in general, one of the reasons that the cost of housing is so high here is that people want to live here, which is a good thing. I remember it's quite a few years ago, it might be 20 years ago. It was a story in Iowa where there were small towns in Iowa that were actually homesteading. They were literally offering abandoned homes to people for free. But the condition was you'd have to come and live there. They give you the house.
Yeah, I remember that.
We don't have that problem here. Let's find out. The chair from USC's Lust Center for Real Estate, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show, Professor Richard Green. Good morning, Professor Green. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. So this is not obviously a news story, the cost of housing. This has become a major political issue. And, you know, we keep coming back to one fundamental issue. How do you build affordable housing in a place where the lots that you build on are so pricey? Unless you've got to subsidize them.
Yeah, well, I think the big issue in California is we're not zoned properly for the demand pressures we have here. So, for example, Los Angeles is one of the 20 largest metropolitan areas in the world. If you visit any of the others, you see lots and lots and lots of multifamily buildings and fairly small numbers of single-family buildings. L.A. is the city that was built to be a single-family city, and that was okay for a while. But we have run out of land not because of nature, but because we have zoned ourselves into being a low-density city. And we would have lots of opportunity to increase the number of houses we build here. We just took advantage of our boulevards more. As you drive down, say, Venice Boulevard, you'll see sort of small, low-density shopping centers. And if you could convert those streets into something you might see in Paris with five- and six-story buildings, they don't have to be skyscrapers. You could fit a lot more housing here than we fit here. But until we do something like that, basically, as you say, lots are scarce. The scarcity has been created by the regulatory regime in which we live, and so the lots are expensive. So you're exactly right. That's the thing that makes it so expensive to build housing here in Southern California.
Now, the issue, because I remember quite a few years ago, there was a move afoot to do this along Ventura Boulevard, that Ventura Boulevard has mostly single-story and in some cases two-story buildings with commercial and professional along that very, very vital stretch of Southern California real estate. But there's densely crowded neighborhoods, single-family homes, and actually apartments and condos behind those stores, both north and south of the boulevard, and the neighbors don't want it. And this is where we have the perpetual problem that your politicians, the city council members and mayors, have to plan for future growth for a city, but they run into the buzzsaw of people who, and I don't blame them for this, if you live in a neighborhood, you want a say in what the character of your neighborhood is.
Yeah, well, so the thing that makes this politically so difficult is, if you think about it, renters and homeowners have opposite interests here. So if you're a homeowner, you, of course, don't want any more housing to get built, because then the value of your home will go up, and you like the value of your home to go up. But if you're a renter, you want lots of stuff built, because if there's lots of supply, and here's a place where economics really works,
yep,
then you're going to put downward pressure on rents, and it's going to be easier for you to rent. And homeowners tend to be far more politically active than renters. And so you get the result that you just described. You're exactly right, that the homeowners are saying, hey, We don't want the value of our house to stabilize, let alone fall. We want it to keep rising. And so you have an incentive to fight against the sort of changes that could lead to housing becoming more affordable here in California.
We're talking with Richard Green, Richard K. Green, chair of USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate. I'll tell you, I hear another factor in this, too. I've actually, certainly the economic factor of you want rising home prices if you're a homeowner. I want to qualify that a little bit because, for instance, my wife and I, a bunch of years, around 2004, we were considering buying another house until we started looking at how expensive they were in 2004. And then we said, no way. You know, we'd been priced out of it. Even if we sold the house that we were in, we would be increasing our payments and our mortgage and our debt obligations so greatly. So that rising home price can also make you a prisoner. Your starter home could be your finisher home because you can't really afford to move to another place with rising home prices. And the other factor I wanted to throw out is one of the things I hear all the time, Richard, from people who object, the NIMBYs who object to higher density housing being built near them, is traffic, is that they just don't want to have it takes forever to get from point A to point B as it is. And if you build apartment buildings and condominiums and you go up to five stories, you're just bringing in that many more people.
No, and that's fair. And so you can't do this in isolation. And so if you look at cities that have succeeded with density, they basically use the density as a mechanism to fund really good transit. So, for example, in Hong Kong, when you build a very tall building, they build lots of them in Hong Kong, the developer bids for the ability to do that building, and then the money that's raised, and they do this through auction processes, goes into putting in the infrastructure, sewer, water, and most particularly subway line that allows people to get around Hong Kong quite nicely without having to get into their car. And so you're absolutely right. One of the things people talk about is you'd be changing the character of L.A. if you were to do this. And that's absolutely right. But what I would ask is it sustainable to have the city continue to be so reliant on cars, a city of its size? If you're Salt Lake City, yes, having a car-based city is just fine. But I think we have to think about how do we make this transformation in Los Angeles where people are having the option of not getting in a car to get from home to work every day. And good transit actually makes that feasible. We're not there yet.
No, we're not. And this is, and I'm glad you brought this point up because this is this isn't even a pet peeve of mine. It's actually a feral peeve, and I've had to tie it out in the yard. The road diet, the traffic calming, all these Orwellian euphemisms that the city has come up to essentially make people's commutes deliberately more difficult so that they will abandon the single passenger vehicle and use either public transportation or bikes to get to and from work. I don't know why this is hard for people to grasp because it's not that complex a thought to hold in your head. I'm 100% in favor because I believe it is inevitable, and having lived in New York City, I've seen it work. We simply have no choice but to accommodate mass transit, to invest in mass transit for the future, because we can't keep widening the 405. We can't keep stuffing vehicles onto Wilshire Boulevard and La Brea and expecting the city to function with the population growth we expect. But to do this before those transportation options exist is punitive. And that's what it seems to me what we've been doing in too many places, which is why the Recall Mike Bonin movement is going forward over in the Venice Del Mar area, Vista Del Mar area, because essentially they've taken lanes away from people, made their commute so much harder, pushed traffic through residential neighborhoods off of the boulevards, and people don't have a practical alternative. I live in the West San Fernando Valley. I can't ride a bicycle to work. It's 106 degrees. You know, what am I going to do?
Right. Well, so at least we are building transit pretty rapidly here. Now, I actually have some issues with the kind of transit. I think light rail is just doesn't have sufficient capacity or speed to do the job. And if I could be king of the world, we would have used heavy rail a lot more and dedicated bus lanes. But yes, as I said, it's a legitimate worry right now that if you build up without the transit infrastructure, traffic will get worse. I'd be lying. As much as I advocate for building more and building up, you have to do both. You have to both put in that ability for people to get around, that alternative for people to get around. But as you said, if you actually do it right, as they've done in New York, as they've done in London, as they've done in Singapore, it actually can make for a very pleasant city.
Yes, it absolutely does. You hop. But now, again, the New York City subway system was built 100 years ago. And yeah. if you go back, as I have, and you read contemporary newspaper reports, it's utterly fascinating. Of course, you can look this stuff up now. There were street collapses. Businesses were destroyed because the roads were torn up as they were trying to stick a subway system under a living city. The same thing has happened here in L.A. when they were putting the Red Line in up around Lancashire Boulevard. Mm-hmm. The sidewalks
Hollywood
were sinking.
Boulevard.
But
yeah.
Because it's an enormous engineering task. But the thing is, once the work is done, it then becomes the city is unimaginable without it. So it's one of these things
exactly.
Where the future generations really will modern New York City. New York has its current problems because they've neglected the maintenance on the transportation system. They've had a terrible, terrible year with the MTA and a big fight between Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo, who's actually in charge of the MTA in New York politics. The governor of New York actually runs the MTA, not the city, which is peculiar. So you've got all that kind of shenanigans. But the bottom line is that this generation of New Yorkers owes a great debt of gratitude to the people from a century ago who had the vision, wisdom, and money to invest in a transportation grid that has served millions and millions and millions of people for 100+ years. And someday, some future Angelenos will feel the same way about what we're doing right now. But unfortunately, we've got the growing pains.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I wish I could tell you that pain was avoidable. But we're going to face either the pain of housing values and rents continuing to rise, and that might mean that people don't come here who would otherwise come here. So, for example, you know, one of the great parlor games right now is where's Amazon's second headquarters going to go?
Right.
I think there is no way it comes to Southern California. Now, one of the reasons for that, I just don't think they're going to come to the West Coast. I think if you're going to build a second headquarters, you're going to build it far away from your first headquarters. But the other thing is, if you look at their documents, they want to go to a place where people can afford houses. And we're not one of those places.
No, we're not.
And so there's pain to what we have right now. But you're absolutely right. The transition to something new is going to be painful. And I wish in our discussions about stuff, we'd be willing to talk realistically about the fact that we have to choose one kind of pain or another.
Well, I agree. This is if we don't build it, they come. If we build it, they come. But if we don't build it, they come. And that's just the sad. That's just the reality. It's not even a sad reality. It is just the reality. Hey, listen. Thanks for the conversation. We appreciate it. The chair of USC's Lusk Center for Real Estate, Richard K. Green. Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on today.
Somebody's got to explain this to me because it's absolutely confounding. How the state of California and the governor signed this bill on Friday that reduces from a felony to a misdemeanor the crime of knowingly exposing a sexual partner to HIV without disclosing the infection. And this also applies to those who give blood to blood banks and they know that they're HIV, but they don't tell the blood bank when they're donating that they are HIV positive. To talk to us about this is a deputy district attorney for L.A. County, but he is not speaking in his official capacity, rather in his own capacity, on his own behalf. And it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, David Berger. David, good morning, sir.
Yes, good morning, Doug.
Thanks for coming on.
Yes, quite a little stinker the governor dropped on us late on a Friday afternoon ahead of a holiday weekend. I wonder why. Could it be, perhaps, that nobody would pick it up other than, of course, Doug McIntyre, who has an eagle eye for all things questionable? And this one really is a head-scratcher, isn't it, Doug? I mean, why would you want to do this? Not only, as you said, have you essentially decriminalized knowingly infecting or transmitting HIV or AIDS, donating blood knowing that you have HIV or AIDS, And the third one was that prostitutes who have already been convicted of prostitution and have been tested positive for HIV or AIDS no longer face a felony conviction if they subsequently have unprotected sex with a client. So why?
And then expanding it to the blood donation system, to the blood banks. Now, again, the blood is supposed to be screened, but certainly if you have somebody who is maliciously trying to taint the blood supply, and that's what we're talking about. Again, we're not talking about someone out of ignorance or a mistake. We're talking about knowingly. That word is very specific. Who is deliberately trying to spread the virus that causes AIDS. And wants to taint the blood pool by donating tainted blood. If this was anthrax, we wouldn't decriminalize that.
Well, you know, you have to look at, first of all, who was the author of this bill to get some, you know, idea of what the agenda is. And I'll shortcut it for you. It's basically identity politics. Scott Wiener, who's from the San Francisco area, the representative there, authored this bill. He is openly gay. In 2014, he published a blog on HuffPost saying, quote, "Each morning I take a bill called Truvada to protect me from becoming infected with HIV." In essence, where Mr. Wiener is coming from is that there is now medicine that can prevent the spread of HIV should you be unfortunate enough to be deliberately infected with this thing, either through sex or through a blood transfusion or contact with a prostitute. So don't worry, you've got medicine, it'll take care of it. And in so doing, the Human Rights Campaign, of which he was a former member, said it modernizes several provisions of the criminal code. Severely outdated HIV criminalization laws, blah, blah, blah. The ACLU, of course, also weighed in on it with the Melissa Goodman, the project director with the ACLU of Southern California, said, quote, "California's outdated and draconian HIV criminal laws have disproportionately harmed people of color and transgender women." Okay. If I had hair left on my head to scratch, I'd be scratching it. I just don't understand what this is, unless it's part of some plan for Mr. Wiener to enhance his reputation and credibility in the gay community with a view to some future run for higher office. Perhaps that's what it's all about.
Well, I guess that's as good a guess as any, but I just don't understand how anybody would support... In fact, if anything, you would think that the gay community and the intravenous drug user community, if you will, are the most vulnerable to people who would. And again, it's not like there's a lot of people out there who are consciously trying to spread HIV, but. But if you're
making... but what about the people who don't have access to the pill, who aren't taking it every day to not contract this disease?
I'm just trying to... It still defies logic as to why you would decriminalize the conscious, deliberate attempt to infect somebody.
Oh, come on, guys. Get over it. Take a pill. You know, if you like your pill, you can keep your pill. How many more of this sort of nonsense are we going to have to put up with? This is what happens when you have a supermajority in Sacramento. California, get used to it. This is what's happening. There is no real accountability now for whatever decriminalization laws are passed. These previous felonies now are misdemeanors that carry a maximum of 6 months in jail. Nobody ever gets that. And anybody previously convicted under the existing laws can now apply to have their convictions reduced. If they're currently in prison or jail serving sentences, they are out. Let's just moveon.com and like I said, get over it, take a pill. That seems to be the justification for this strange piece of legislation, which, of course, sailed through Sacramento without a question mark, except from, the very small Republican side, Senator Joel Anderson of Alpine voted against the bill, arguing it puts the public at risk.
Of course it does.
You know, he said, I'm of the mind that if you purposely inflict another with a disease that alters their lifestyle, the rest of their life, puts them on a regimen of medications to maintain some kind of normalcy, it should be a felony. Quote, it's absolutely crazy to me that we should go light on this. And, you know, it's hard to disagree with him.
David Berger can be followed on Twitter at DragnetLA, at DragnetLA, a deputy district attorney. But, of course, Mr. Berger was appearing today in his own on his own behalf. And the opinions expressed thereof are his own opinions and not that of the district attorney's office. Thank you, David. Always appreciate it. There's tons to talk about today, including, of course, the immigration issue, which has reached a stalemate yet again, even though I believe a deal is available should our political institutions be able to move past the short-term political benefit of keeping the crisis going. In this case, I believe it's the ball's in the Democrats' court. The president has indicated repeatedly that he's willing to make a deal for the DREAM Act kids, the DACA kids. But you can't make a deal if you don't have anybody to deal with. And both Charles Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are doubling down on a quote-unquote clean bill. They want an amnesty-only bill for the DREAM Act kids. And, of course, that's a repetition of the blunder that was made back in the 80s, the so-called Simpson-Mazzoli, or the a.k.a. the Reagan amnesty. To talk about this right now is Numbers USA Director of Policy and Activism. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Chris Chmielinski. Chris, how are you?
Good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Listen, from my perspective, what I see is a Democratic Party that has decided that they, in fact, will hold the DREAM Act kids hostage because they'd rather have this issue to run on in 2018 than solve it now.
Yeah, and you know, the last thing that they want is Donald Trump standing in the Rose Garden, flanked by these DACA recipients, giving them a pathway to legal citizenship. So that's not an optic they want. And yeah, they'd prefer to use it. You know, if they really had the best interest of the DACA recipients and the Dreamers, they would be sitting at the table, at the negotiating table, and trying to work out a deal with the administration. But, you know, they don't have a whole lot of interest, and there are some of those, a lot of those Dreamers, especially the vocal ones, are saying, we want the whole enchilada or nothing. We want all amnesty for all 11 million people with no concessions. And certainly that's making things difficult for the Democrats right now.
Yeah, and partisan politics is at play here. And in the interest of just accuracy, forget about ideology. It's just these are just the facts, ma'am. The Republican Party, that myself included, that wants to see border security, understands that the DREAM Act kids are the ante to get in the game, that the DREAM Act kids, in essence, are being held hostage to both sides of this equation. And I don't know any other way to make it happen, because to not get border security this time around is to replicate the disaster that was the Simpson-Mazzoli bill, the Reagan amnesty. We would simply have a quote-unquote clean bill that would give amnesty to the DREAM Act kids, and then once that goal is achieved, you're not going to get anything of substance out of the Democrats in the House or the Senate on border security. So, unfortunately, the DREAM Act kids must be used as the bargaining chip, but I think that there is a real opportunity to address their situation here. But you have to have a negotiating partner, and I don't see one. I don't see that the Democrats are willing to do anything of substance when it comes to the border. They just rhetoric and say they're in favor of it. They're in favor of secure borders, but when push comes to shove, they always shove.
Right, and you saw that in the president's tweet. I think it was yesterday that he tweeted that out, that the Democrats aren't interested in securing the country. You know, you've referred to the 1986 bill. That was the last time this country saw a mass amnesty, and that was supposed to be the last amnesty that ever took place.
Oh, yeah. Well, Congress could ever say, no president can ever say one time only. They have no effect on what the future is.
Right, and that bill had promises of enforcement. It had border security. It had workplace verification. It had some other provisions that were included in it that was supposed to end illegal immigration. Well, here we are 30 years later, and we've got 11 million people, including these 700,000 DACA recipients that are in the country. And all I think the White House is asking, all we're asking, and I think all the American people, for that matter, are asking, are for a solution. Let's end illegal immigration once for all. Is that so hard to ask for? And if you're going to grant another amnesty, then at least let's make sure that we never have to do it again. But this time, let's mean it. And that means let's secure the border. Let's require businesses to use E-Verify and take away the jobs magnet. Let's get in place a biometric entry exit system. Let's beef up interior enforcement so criminal aliens aren't deported and just released out onto the streets to jeopardize public safety. That's all the people are asking for, and that's what you saw in November when Trump beat Clinton. You know, he said that he was going to take care of this. He was going to try to end illegal immigration. But as you said, nobody, right now at least, seems to be, at least on the Democratic side, wants to sit down at the table with them and have a rational discussion about this, a reasonable discussion.
We're talking with Chris Chmielinski, who's the Numbers USA Director of Policy and Activism at NumbersUSA.com. And the reality is that there certainly are many people in the Republican Party that aren't that interested in it either. They've got a little bit more difficult putt because they have to pretend that they care for political reasons. But the corporatist wing of the Republican Party has wanted open borders for their own agenda. And that's, of course, how this collapsed, why the two-party system failed the country so utterly on this issue, because for different reasons, Republicans and Democrats have both been willing to surrender the sovereignty of the nation. The Democrats, for political gain, they know that a future amnesty will give them maybe a perpetual electoral majority and, of course, more customers for the social welfare programs that they administer. And the corporatist Republicans are getting cheap labor, the insourced workers, for those jobs that can't be outsourced. But within Republican councils, there were and remain some people who actually get it, who really care about the issue. The problem is whether or not they can hold the president's attention. The president has repeatedly threatened that if Congress won't act on the Dream Act kids, he'll do it himself. So what does that mean? Does that mean that if Congress doesn't act, he just essentially grants his own version of DACA?
Well, yeah, and I think there are some Republicans that have gotten his ear, Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue, who introduced the RAISE Act, which would reform the legal immigration system, and that's included in the White House principles that came out this past weekend. So they've gotten his ear. They're trying to spread that message. What we really need is we need Trump to be a little bit more forthcoming on this. You know, they released the principles the night before a federal holiday, so it got some press coverage but didn't get a ton. You know, he's got to go out and say, listen, I'm ready to deal. I'm ready to make a deal here, but here are my conditions. And we need to know exactly, you know, it's not good enough just for the White House spokesperson to say it or for Stephen Miller to say it. We need for Trump to actually say it. And then when we get 6 months from now and DACA is essentially terminated, when that renewal period is over, I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know if he's going to just continue the program or extend the deadline or what he's going to do if Congress hasn't acted yet. But at some time, he's got to put pressure on Congress. And he's taken the first step by ending DACA. But he has left that six-month window open now, and he said that he'll readdress it at the end of that 6 months. So we're not sure what he's going to do. We're hopeful that he doesn't do anything. And he forces Congress to take action. But we know how Congress is. When they need to take action, they try to figure out ways to delay and not do anything.
Chris, thanks for coming on with us. Appreciate it. The website, again, is numbersusa.com, numbersusa.com. And, of course, this fight is far from over. Appreciate you coming on with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Okay. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Dianne Feinstein announcing that she's going to seek yet another six-year term in office as a United States Senator from California. And to talk to us about this, it's a pleasure to welcome Pepperdine adjunct professor and co-publisher of Fox and Hounds Daily, Joel Fox. Good morning, Mr. Fox. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. McIntyre.
Thank you.
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, thanks for coming on with us. Here's something that I didn't expect to say in this lifetime, but I believe that Dianne Feinstein, who was rumored to be ready to walk away from the Senate, and granted at her age, no one would blame her, but I actually think that she is doing both the state of California and the nation a patriotic service by running for this office. And here's why I say that. Because the people warming up in the on-deck circle are crazier by a country mile than she is. And she knows it. And she does know it. She knows that, look at who wants that job. Kevin De Leon, the president pro tem of the California Senate, the author of SB 54, the sanctuary bill, and other catastrophes. And that's the caliber, the ilk that's ready to jump into the United States Senate representing California. And I think she's looking around and saying, these people can't be in the Senate.
Well, you know, there's a long list of people who would jump at that job if she decided she wasn't going to run. And I think the reason the focus, and a few names, by the way, are mayor here in Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, Representative Schiff from Burbank, who got a lot of attention with the congressional hearings on President Trump, a couple of congressmen like Brad Sherman, Ted Lieu. I think the attention on Kevin De Leon is because he has no place to go. He's termed out as president of the Senate. He's an ambitious politician, and there is no other office to run for unless he decides to run for governor. He actually has a very large kitty for lieutenant governor, but he doesn't seem to want to run for that race. The other person, and I think this person probably will fall into the same category, Doug, that you just described, who might be interested in running, is billionaire Tom Steyer, the environmentalist. That is another name that has been brought about. And both of those, Steyer and De Leon, are very much from the Democratic progressive left who want to move to join the movement of California to the left. And so that's where all the attention is. However, I think that the political math lines up for Senator Feinstein for many reasons. I mean, you mentioned it earlier in the show. It's going to be a real long shot for a Republican to even get into the final race. Remember, we have a top two primary here in California. And it's possible, I suppose, if you have a strong attack from the left and Feinstein's involved and they split the vote a little bit and there is a name Republican, it's possible you could get a Republican finishing second, but then that Republican would have very little chance in November. But in a top two primary, if it ends up to be Senator Feinstein and someone like Senator De Leon or Tom Steyer, then Feinstein, I think, with her reputation and for all the reasons, Doug, that you talked about, would definitely be the favorite to retain her seat.
Oh, I don't think Dianne Feinstein is beatable in the state of California. She might have a struggle this time. What do we mean by struggle? 5-point win? The bottom line, which most people would look at a very comfortable win because of her age factor, and the progressives will land a few blows because she's not being mean enough to Donald Trump. But the bottom line is that the lieutenant governor's job is obviously going to be up for grabs because Gavin Newsom seems intent on becoming the next governor of California. Eric Garcetti may end up running for president. We've discussed that many times. And Garcetti, for a number of reasons, it makes sense for him to run for president of the United States. While it's unlikely he would get the nomination, he could end up as a running mate for a Democratic nominee, raise his profile. He's young enough for some future run for office. I can make a compelling case of why Eric Garcetti doesn't want to be governor of California, because I think he knows where the bodies are buried in that budget. I think he knows that the next governor is going to be the governor who has to say no to a lot of people, and you don't make friends saying no.
Yeah, I think that the governor's race is probably not what he's interested in. Now, he's keeping his options open because it certainly keeps his names in the newspapers that are still around. and I think running, if he does run for president, Doug, I think your analysis is right. He's actually running for vice president and keeping his name alive. So I think that's part of the strategy here. But as far as Feinstein's concerned, yeah, she'll take some blows from the progressives. And, you know, she said things that got a lot of attention, like, well, President Trump could be a good president. And the progressives hated that comment, and they went after her.
She said just recently, Joel, she just recently said that there's no law that would have, there's no law that would have stopped the Las Vegas shooting. And, of course, that's heresy in the progressive circles.
That's right, and she was the author of the federal assault weapons ban in 1994, so she has a track record on going after some gun control laws, but Kevin DeLeon did attack her for that. So, and of course, the age issue will be played to some extent. She's going to be 85 if she's reelected. She'll be 91. I think I read if she served her full term, she'd be only one of five people in the history of the United States who was over 90 in the U.S. Senate. But it's interesting, a lot of the progressives who are after her and talking about age are fans of Bernie Sanders, who's 76 years old. So I don't know that the age issue is going to play out, but you see a lot of chessboard suggestions. Here's one I read you might find, like, that if she runs, is elected, and does not decide to serve the full term, the next governor of California gets to appoint her replacement. And who might the next governor be? Could it be Gavin Newsom, who the progressives like? And is that where the progressives may step back? Or would the next governor appoint himself or herself to the position, opening up the job for the lieutenant governor, and then maybe Kevin DeLeon should run for lieutenant governor? A lot of strategy going on. A lot of it fun to think about, but a lot of it's not going to happen.
We're talking with Joel Fox, who is the co-publisher of foxandhoundsdaily.com, and that's an excellent website, by the way. Folks, for California news, something that we could use more of, because the state is run in almost total anonymity, which is part of the problem. And I'm also an adjunct professor at Pepperdine University. Hey, Joel, what's going to happen with the Republican Party in the state of California? Where do you see this headed?
It's really quite a question. You know, there's a recent statement. We talked about my job over at Pepperdine. Kristen Olson's coming by to speak to my class next week, and she just resigned as the vice chair of the Republican Party because there was a resolution that was put forth that was going to be voted on to try to take her down as the vice chair in the next convention. And there's while we are talking, we started this conversation, Doug, about the internal combat in the Democratic Party. Between the progressives and the more moderates. We saw that not only in this discussion about Feinstein, but even in the election of the most recent head of the Democratic Party in California, Eric Bauman, who won a bare majority against a progressive challenger. There is certainly a split in the Republican Party, where some Republicans who are more conservative are trying to move those who are more moderate, like Ms. Olson, out of position. And if Republicans don't unify around a message, they become smaller and smaller in their effect on California politics. Right now, there's only about a 1 percentage point difference between registered Republicans and registered independents, or no party.
Yeah, declined to state, right. I mean, the Republican Party is this close to being a minor party, and also the party is already a perpetual also-ran. There's a couple of congressional seats that they can grab, and a stray assembly district here and there. But as a viable opposition party, and as a viable party that could someday be a majority party, it's non-existent. And the only thing that's likely to happen is it's going to take a crisis of monumental proportions, a real genuine meltdown in the state of California before folks will. I think the brand is so tarnished in this state, and the state has taken such a step to the left that it's just hard to imagine how a Republican, even a moderate Republican, wins.
Here's a comparison I make often, and sometimes you'll hear my accent, Doug, but I grew up in Massachusetts. And if you look at the state of Massachusetts, the independent voter, the whatever they call them back there, is declined the state voter, actually is a majority of the population there, but they tend to vote Democrat, and so the legislature has very few Republicans in the legislature. But I think of the last four or five governors in Massachusetts, three of them were Republicans. And I think one of the things, the reason that occurs is because the Democrats have such a strong control over that state legislature that the voters every once in a while say, you know what, we need a Republican in the governorship just as a check to make sure it doesn't go off the boards. Could that happen here in California? You know, a lot of people say, and you and I have had this discussion many times, believe it or not, Jerry Brown is the adult in the room. He's the one that keeps a lid on the legislature going off the tracks. Could it happen that the voters of California, at some point, if the legislature continues to move further to the left, finally say, you know what, we need a check on this, and the way we're going to do that is elect a Republican as governor of the state? A little far-fetched, but if you look at Massachusetts history, I think it's possible that could be a model for what might happen here down the road.
All right, Joel, as always, thanks for coming on. Always appreciate it. Joel Fox, foxandhoundsdaily.com. Ladies and gentlemen, California, as you know, the voters of California, even though we took this quantum step to the left in the last number of election cycles, while the rest of the country seemed to be going right, one of the issues that California voters were pretty emphatic about was speeding up the death penalty. And yet, the pushback continues at the regulatory level, lawsuits, etc. And this time it was California regulators for the second time on Monday rejected a proposed new method for carrying out the death penalty by lethal injection. To talk to us about this right now is the legal director for the Criminal Justice League Foundation, Kurt Schediger. Kurt, how are you?
Hi. Good morning. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. First of all, tell us what the Justice League, the Criminal Justice League Foundation is and what they're about.
We're a nonprofit legal foundation founded in 1982, and we basically support the rights of victims of crime in the criminal justice process. So we're generally on the law enforcement side.
Got it. And, you know, as I mentioned in the preamble here, despite the fact that California voters voted for essentially every liberal proposition and candidate, the ballot measure that would expedite the death penalty in California, 750 inmates on death row, passed overwhelmingly. And yet the fight continues just at the bureaucratic level and in courtrooms.
Well, it did pass. I wouldn't say overwhelmingly, but yeah, that is correct. California's voters have been consistently, time after time after time, voting in favor of the death penalty in appropriate cases and most recently to fix the procedure. Now, here we are a year after the election almost, and this provision remains stayed by the California Supreme Court. While they considered a challenge to the constitutionality of the initiative, they decided it was constitutional and upheld it, rejecting every single argument the opponents made. Then the opponents filed a petition for rehearing, and it remained stayed while they considered that petition. Now, one of the provisions that we put in Proposition 66 was to take this Office of Administrative Law completely out of the loop. These bureaucrats should not have any part in this process. The Department of Corrections establishes the protocol. The courts review that. It's challenged every single time. There is absolutely no need to have this additional layer of bureaucracy. The people of California have voted against it, and it should be put into effect as soon as possible.
Now, of course, it's what should happen and what will happen are two different things.
Yeah.
I mean, even a court case at least appears on a court docket. But when you get into a bureaucracy, how do you get the bureaucracy to move forward?
Well, they do have timelines. And first of all, we at this moment, we only have a notice that they rejected this regulation. They haven't told us why. Supposedly, they're going to tell us within a week or so. But as far as the OAL goes, I'm very hopeful that the California Supreme Court will reassert its decision with only minor modifications, and they will just be out of the picture. As far as the Department of Corrections goes, we had to sue them 2 years ago to make them move. They weren't going to promulgate a protocol, and we brought suit on behalf of two of the murder victims' families to make them move forward with the protocol. So the answer to your question is, that's how you do it.
What is the Department of Corrections objection?
Well, the Department of Corrections isn't the one with the objection. It's the Office of Administrative Law at present. I mean, they did comply with our settlement, and they did move forward with their protocol.
Okay. By the way, we're talking with Kurt Scheidegger, who's the legal director for the Criminal Justice League Foundation. You know, this issue is not just a California issue. There are other states that have been taken to court and have had, you know, the pharmaceutical companies that make the chemicals that were used in lethal injection. Some states are actually considering going back to firing squad. And one of the options is the gas chamber.
Well, Oklahoma has gone forward and established an alternative procedure, which is to use pure nitrogen as a method of execution, which is very different than the hydrogen cyanide that was used in the past. If you inhale pure nitrogen, which is, you know, two-thirds of the air anyway, it simply deprives the brain of oxygen and people go to sleep and then die. It's really a better way to go in the long run.
So where do you anticipate this heading? What's the next step?
Probably the next step is for the California Supreme Court to reassert its decision upholding Proposition 66, and at that point the Office of Administrative Law will no longer have any say in this matter. And then we have to get CDCR to implement the protocol that they have already written.
Is this something that Governor Brown can use the executive power of the governor's office to throw more obstacles and impediments in the way?
Well, CDCR does work for Governor Brown, and he appoints the secretary. So that's not out of the realm of possibility. I think probably the earlier foot-dragging that we had to sue them about might have been because they knew he didn't want it to go forward. But so far, he hasn't overtly thrown obstacles in the way. It's been more a case of foot-dragging.
All right. Well, that's in some ways, it's a covert enemy. It's harder to fight that. Than it is.
Yeah,
if you just...
it is. Yeah, I mean, they took the position when we sued them that they it was within their discretion to just sit on it forever, and we got a preliminary ruling from a judge. No, it wasn't. They had to go forward, and at that point, they settled.
All right. Well, Kurt, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue to follow the story. Appreciate it from the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, Kurt Scheidegger. I'm not sure that the world was prepared for the announcement yesterday by the Boy Scouts of America that they're going to expand to let girls join the Boy Scouts in segregated by gender girl troops within the Boy Scouts umbrella so that they can earn Eagle Scout rank. This has irritated, to say the least, the Girl Scouts of America. And joining us right now to talk about this is the Director of Marketing and Advocacy for Girl Scouts of America, Los Angeles, Kenya Yarborough. Kenya, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you coming on with us. So, did you have any advance notice that this was going to happen?
Well, we'd known about 2 months ago. We had heard that the Boy Scouts were considering this option. So, we did have kind of a heads up that this could be a possibility, yes.
And obviously, the obvious question is, what does this mean for the Girl Scouts?
Well, it means that this week we've been given a great opportunity to talk about how fantastic Girl Scouting is, actually. We're reacting, like I said, we did have a little heads-up notice, but we are just continuing to tell our story, telling how Girl Scouting for 105 years has been the premier girl leadership experience in the world. And any opportunity to really talk about Girl Scouts and how our program is the best for girls is a great opportunity. So we're using this time to really talk about how our girls are immersed in amazing programs, high-impact programs that are engaging, and we are going to continue to do that four girls, girl-led, in a girl-only space that is safe and gives them the opportunity to grow and thrive and learn the best.
Now, one of the issues that was brought up as the reason this is happening is that because the Boy Scouts have the Eagle program, which is a notable achievement and a great talking point on a resume for getting into colleges, for getting hired for that matter, in career opportunities, that the Girl Scouts of America does not have an equivalent program. Is that something that we might see the Girl Scouts add?
Well, that's actually incorrect, McIntyre, and that is another reason why I was saying this is a fantastic opportunity for us to clarify some misconceptions. We absolutely do have an equivalent. It turned 100 years old in 2016, and it's called the Girl Scout Gold Award. It is the highest honor in Girl Scouting, and it has similar requirements, the community service and advocacy requirements, and I might add that it actually has greater requirements than the current Eagle Scout process.
Now, how is it possible that I didn't know that until this minute?
That is exactly why we still need Girl Scouts, because it's important that we really talk about how girls are thriving and growing and that they have the potential to be great leaders. And I don't think that, and let's be honest, that our society really looks at it that way. And the prestige is given to the Eagle Scout that we're familiar with and that was the first scouting award before ours, I think 2 or 3 years ahead, as we were founded 2 or 3 years behind the Boy Scouts. But that's actually kind of the point of Girl Scouts, of really talking about and touting what girls are doing in society. And Girl Scouting absolutely provides high impact and high adventure camping. Absolutely. Here in Los Angeles, we have 41 robotics teams, many of whom are national champions. We are doing amazing things in Girl Scouts, specifically for Girl Scouts, with the research and support that provides great programming that is just for girls and putting girls in front. So we absolutely do. It's called the Girl Scout Gold Award. It is now 102 years old this coming year, and we had an amazing celebration of its centennial in 2016, where we really tried to lead campaigns to educate people about this very high honor that girls Scouts can use on their resumes and also in their college applications. So it's been really fantastic. And again, like I said, fantastic in that this is really giving us an opportunity to talk about Girl Scouts, and that you and your listeners and many people across the country can stop and say, oh, I didn't know that about Girl Scouts. Let me rethink Girl Scouts and rethink this decision that the Boy Scouts have made.
We're talking with Kenya Yarborough, who is the Director of Marketing and Advocacy for Girl Scouts of Greater Los Angeles. Our youngest son is an Eagle Scout, and I was in the Boy Scouts, and the worst troop in the history of Boy Scouts, by the way, without question. But that demerit aside, I find this decision by the Boy Scouts to be perplexing on a number of fronts, not the least of which is virtually every child psychologist, developmental psychologist will tell you that boys and girls, any parent of boys and girls,
yes,
will know that they develop differently and they have different needs and react differently at different periods of their development. And that's one of the things that has been a great virtue of the all-boys Boy Scouts of America and the all-girls Girl Scouts of America. And it just seems like the Boy Scouts are come up with a solution in search of a problem.
I might tend to agree. I don't know. I don't work for the Boy Scouts, but you make an excellent point that while we as Girl Scouts are taking this opportunity to talk about that research that you mentioned, to talk about the time-tested process, the how girls and boys grow, thrive, and how Girl Scouting gives girls the opportunity to really step up and step forward and step out and take the lead, you make a good point that that is also true for Boy Scouts in an all-boy environment.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I make it across the spectrum. There are boys have different requirements than girls do. And what works for boys in an all-boy environment changes dramatically if you add girls to the mix.
Yes, And both of these organizations are very important and supplemental to youth development. This is where we fill in the soft skills. They're learning academics at school, but this is where Girl Scouts provides confidence and courage. And we found in the research that girls tend to shy away or step back in those dual gender situations, and Girl Scouting is there to provide that development and encouragement for girls to empower themselves. And I mean, let's face it, we live in a co-ed society, but we're giving girls the skills and the tools and the resources to be able to, yes, the word is compete, but also thrive. Yep. To be able to speak their mind, you know, to step forward.
Well, we were certainly happy to speak with you this morning. Thanks so much for coming on and talking to us
about it.
Kenya Yarborough from the Girl Scouts of Greater Los Angeles. We appreciate you being with us this morning.
This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.